This particular process is somewhat of a challenge for me. I don't do this well. So we'll try and get through this. I want to try and create a picture for you this morning that will give you a picture, I guess that's the word to use. In my lifetime, I look at, you know, I've been married 43 years, I'm 63 years old. I look at my life and what's happened, and you know, we moved into another house 5 years ago. I just am overwhelmed by the concept that 5 years has flown by, not to mention the years prior to that. I've got children that will be 40 years old this year. Already have one who's attained that. The next one's going to. The end of the year, I'll have 7 grandchildren. How did I get here? And by the nods in the audience, you're saying, I don't know how I got here either. The vast movement of time continues on. Here was one of the most startling statistics in the development as I was going through this process of looking at this concept. In my lifetime, the population of the United States has doubled. We are now, last census, and I'm rounding these figures off. At 300 million people. Actually, the census implies that there's close to 308 million people in the United States today. Now, I wrote that up there because we're gonna do a comparison to that pretty soon. Population in the United States continues to evolve. Births are almost 2 to 1. For every death in the United States, 2 people are born, 2 children born. We're doing our part right here in this congregation. Looking at what is prominent today for us, heart disease, of course, the number one killer of people in America. A couple of years ago, there was 600,000 deaths attributed to heart disease. Cancer. 500,000 people die every year from cancer. Pneumonia, chronic respiratory diseases, strokes. This was an interesting one because it's one I'm familiar with. 75,000 people died as a result of complications of Alzheimer's disease. Diabetes, influenza, pneumonia. Some of them I can't pronounce. That's what is we are, you know, and of course there's accidental deaths in there as well, are dying from in America today. An interesting statistic. Seventy relatives of Jacob went down into Egypt, and when they left, of those 70 sons and grandsons of Jacob, over 600,000 men who were mighty and who had would have been military age, about 20 to 60, left there. That would imply a population of close to 3 million people, men, women, and children, who exited from the land of Egypt on their way back to the Canaan land to fulfill what promise was made by God to Abraham. All nations of the earth would be blessed. And this was the process going through there. They were going back to reclaim the promised land. They would go back and, you know, they'd take a pretty good inhabit to go back there. They would take a good population back to inhabit that land. 3 million people. Later on, David, this is 1,000 years before Christ, took a census. God, and several times in the Bible, has said, I want you to take a census. Not unlike what we do today, a census. You know, count the people. The time of David, having trouble finding the number because I can't see it as well. I do remember this figure, that he counted the number of men, and the number that would have been implied by that number of men, that his kingdom would have consisted of 5 million people. So that whole process of I mean, this was, to me, is a pretty good sized number. 5 million people to live in into the land as it was. By the time Christ came, what happened to that number? The vast majority of them had been taken into Babylonian captivity. And only a remnant returned. And in that process, and in those 400 years that we really don't know much about, they kind of reestablished the Jewish nation, the Hebrews, reestablished somewhat of a population in the region that Paul talked about this morning. That an excellent segue into what I want to talk about this morning. About 45,000 came back from Babylon to inhabit, to command to rebuild, and to reestablish themselves. And of potentially many more than 5 million people. We don't know. Now, moving to the time of Christ, we talked about that this morning. We talked about the Roman Empire, and they were in charge. But they weren't in charge of the world. They were only in charge of a portion of the world. And their population probably consisted of about 45 million, which was probably about 20% of the population. But at the time of Christ, it's estimated, these are estimations, that there was, see if you recognize this figure, about 300 million people at the time of Christ in the world. And Rome had control over a good portion of that. Kind of some similarities there, isn't it? There's even more. Christ began his ministry. Paul did an excellent segue into this morning. And talking about, if you look, if you can remember that map up there, that'll help. That region, he started there in a population that was probably in the millions. Many of those towns, Jerusalem alone, had close to 1 million people in it. And out of those cities around that had 40, 50, 60,000 people. I really had to think about this. How in the world did those people, I mean, they didn't have Summit Shopping Center. How did they manage to feed themselves and care for themselves and clothe themselves and get medical care? And the the logistics of this just overwhelm me when I think about what we have today, the infrastructure that we've built that you can't even see underneath the ground out here. Sanitation would have been an issue. Disease was a problem. There were many, many sick people because of just the way it was. The vast volume of people, vast numbers that were there. And Christ began his ministry at that time. Now, they didn't know any different. You know, to them, that was the normal way of life. Whatever it was, it became, that's what they did. That's how they functioned. They were fine with that. They didn't care how it is. Probably not unlike today. You know, when I look at what it was in the 50s, we didn't have air conditioning. Didn't know it. Didn't know there was such a thing when I was a small child. We had several cars. The funny thing about my childhood is I can remember every car my dad bought. He had a 49 Dodge, he had a 53 Chevrolet, he had a 56 Chevrolet, and in 1959 he bought a brand new one, his first new car he ever had. Brand new Chevrolet Impala. You remember, some of you will remember these, some of you don't, had the big wings on the back. I loved that car. That was an incredibly looking oddball of a vehicle. Didn't have air conditioning. It wasn't an option. But we went down to the local Mark IV dealer, and Dad had one put in there. Wow! Was that a change in life? You know, we had air conditioning. Didn't have it in the house, but we had it in the car. We took a lot of trips in the summertime, as we might relate to. Saw it. Thing on Facebook this week is my sister was reminiscing to that time. She said, I remember when we got air conditioning in the house. We had it in my folks' bedroom, a window unit, and one in the kitchen. I didn't have it. How come she got to get it and I didn't? Well, that was all right. I got married and we bought one, put it in our house. So we had one. Just kind of a thing. You see how the evolution of man has done and become. Christ came here, and what did he have to work with? The power of God, the power of the Holy Spirit in his hand. And he started and did, we only have recorded about 39 of his miracles. But of that we've seen, and I'm convinced, absolutely convinced, the man was here 1,500 days in his ministry. And I'm pretty much convinced that there was a lot more going on than we'll ever know about on this earth. The transformation of the world at that time by Christ must have been absolutely astounding. We see the 4,000, we've been talking about it, we see the 4,000, we see the 5,000 being fed. How in the world does that happen? How do you do that? How did he make the lame to walk? How did he take out demons out of mankind? How did he calm nature? How did he do that without the power of God in his hand? Today, we have the miracles of medicine. I know of several people who have had organs in their bodies fail, and they have organs taken from someone who's less fortunate, who's died from some tragic things, whose organs are still viable. They place them into that, and the recovery is weeks, and for the rest of their life, they have to take these drugs that keep them from going into remission for those things constantly. But their quality of life is much improved because they've got good quality organs now. Christ took people and said it was so obvious that they couldn't walk, they couldn't talk, they couldn't see, that they had people working with them to do the various things. One guy lowered through the roof, another woman touching the hem. We've talked about these things in the last several months. They were very evident and prominent things that happened that Christ, through his power, touched them, spoke the healing to them, and they were made whole. David's missing a finger. Dan's got a hand that's not like his other one. Can you imagine Christ going up and saying, David, I'm restoring your finger to your hand. Dan, I'm going to make your hand whole. And it wasn't a period of a moment in time. It was a moment in time. Boom, and it happened. What effect would that have on us today? I don't know. But if you look at the population, now we'll go back. I want to rebuild this picture. If we look at, this is going to be a kind of an oddball. You may be able to recognize this. Sorry. Got it? Okay. If Christ started his ministry right here, sure, if you know your geography, you know, you can kind of picture where that's at. That would have been about the same geography that Christ would have started in Jerusalem, in Nazareth, in Galilee, in that whole region of land, with approximately the same number of people. What effect do you suppose would happen if this morning that were to happen? What would you do? You go home and say, that was pretty good. That was a pretty good deal. I suspect you would have been in awe. Christ had the same effect. People were in awe. They went and they followed him. They didn't get it. The disciples didn't get it. The apostles didn't completely, totally understand it. It took them a while to realize what he was doing. But in fact, he had that impact upon thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And that being happening today, if it happened today, in a population of 300 million, over here in the world, I can't put the square miles into where the world existed at that time, but approximately 300 million people. And it had an effect on it. There was, as we know over here on the Israelites, a dispersion of those people. There was some 40,000 people up in Rome already. The dispersion of these people was across that area. And it was, became known. We can see that evidence because Paul went to these places and they already had in the gospel. Some of them he preached to it, he preached in there, but it spread. Rome, in Paul's lifetime, who had witnessed Christ, was going to these places to help them establish what Christ did for them because of the miraculous things that he did. It convinced them. And there were people who were accepting this. The gospel of Christ was exploding into the world. I suspect, and I don't know with certainty, that 99, maybe 99.9% of this 300 million people have heard of Christ. Heard the word spoken. Know of him. Know what he is, what we say he is, what we're told that he is. Same thing he had over here. People who had disbelief, people who didn't want to, would have been applied right here. They had the same problems. They had the same sin. Paul talks about it. He's listed it in several of his letters. About the horrible natures of sin. It's prominent in our lives. We see it. We look at some of them and say, is it worse? You know what? I doubt it. I suspect that sin that was there in the time of Christ was of adultery and fornication that just keeps coming up. The things that they dealt with divorce, the things that they dealt with stealing, just go through the list. It's the same list over here. And we're trying to impact that just as Christ did. And the tools we have are the faith that we have that Christ did those things to convince the world that he was, as he talked about this morning, the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. It is a powerful reminder to us. When I look at Christ and his death by men placing myself in their position who saw Christ die, saw him buried, and turn and walk away and take up their lives again after what they had seen in the last 3.5 years, absolutely amazes me. And yet, I'm probably no different. What does the Christian life mean to us today? What effect does your Christian life have on others that you are interact with every day? I'm going to give you a story that it's not a story, it's a true story that happened to me just in recent weeks. I had a pretty big job that needed to be done, and I can do a lot of things, but I tell myself this. I could do a lot of things. There's some things that I don't do well, this being one of them. But this particular job challenged me. I couldn't quite figure out how I was going to do it. So I hired Corbin to come over and help me do it. We were going to grade this area that I need to pour some cement in. We got 10 feet down into the process, and someone pulled in the driveway. He said, "I see you're getting ready to pour some concrete. Have you got your flat work bed?" I never met this man before in my life. Didn't know who he was, didn't know where he lived. And I said, "Well, I've kind of got a guy set up. Yeah, he's going to do that. I have to kind of get the thing ready. That's what we're doing now." He said, "Well, I wonder if I could bid on that." In 10 minutes that I spoke with that man, I knew who he was, I knew what he stood for, and I knew what was important in his life. Right on his truck, he had Psalms 40 and 2. And he told me pretty much straight out, he was a Christian-based organization. In 10 minutes, he gave me a price, and I said, "When can you do it?" He said, "I could probably do it this week." I said, "You've got the job." In 10 minutes, I knew what this man stood for. I knew his relationship with Christ was an extremely important thing to him. And I felt very comfortable in saying, "You got the job, buddy. You do it." And I turned to Corbin and said, "You're fired." I didn't fire him. We did some other things. There was always work to do, but... That's the impact we have on the world. We should have on the world. That's what we are. That's what we do. And yet on the first day of the church, only 3,000 souls were saved. The answer to one of the questions I thought to myself, it was questioned about why didn't they take more. They weren't willing to pull the trigger. They weren't ready to give up the life that they had. They weren't prepared for this complete change. But we saw from the conviction of 3,000 souls exploded into what we have today, hundreds of thousands of people who profess that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. That's what's important. That's what we need to understand. The concept of what Christ did is kind of mind-boggling, but if you put it in perspective, it kind of makes sense that his job was an incredible challenge that he took upon himself to do. He picked 12 men to do it with him. He knew that would be necessary, and they changed the world. Well, in my closing thoughts, I've given a lot of thought to what I could say that would convince someone who's outside of Christ. I'm going to relate to you a little story I heard. It was about how we teach our children. You know, what's the one commandment that children are given? Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. There was a man who had... He was playing in the park, and his children, he had one child that was playing with other children. They were in the sandbox playing and digging and, you know, and running their trucks, and they're doing all that same. And just for the sake of convenience, we'll say, Johnny, it's time to go home. And Johnny keeps playing. Does his little thing. He plays, and he's having a good time. The other boy looks at him and said, your dad's gone. So I know. Second time, Johnny, I need for you to come now. It's time to go home. Johnny keeps playing in the sandbox. He said, your dad's needing you to come. I know. Third time, Johnny, I need for you to come now. Johnny gets up and says, I gotta go. He pictured his dad with the veins bulging on his neck. He heard the loud voice, and he heard the message from his dad to say, it's time for me to go. What happens if that same scenario, they're walking down the sidewalk, 8, 10 years old, I don't know how old the child would be, but you're walking, he's running, having a great time. They're out doing this little walk or jog or hike or whatever it might be, and he's having a wonderful time. They're walking down the sidewalk, and the hedge is about this tall, and the boy is about this tall, and he's running far ahead of Dad, and he says, as he looks up the car backing down the driveway, that they should reach the same point about the same time. How many times will it take Johnny to stop? 3? You do the math. God is our heavenly parent. What's the number of times he's called to you? Is this his first call to you? Is this his second urgent message to you? Or is the third message not in anger, not in the bulge of his veins on his neck, but this night thy soul shall be required of thee? Where are you in that plea from God today? You're running out of daylight. You've not accepted the miracles of Christ. If you have not accepted the desire for him that we talked about in our class this morning, eternal life that he gave to him as the Messiah, if you have not heeded that, I'm giving you an opportunity. Not from me, but from God himself, as he calls you.